This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Boston Red Sox completed a sweep of the California Angels yesterday at Fenway Park. Boston's 8-6 win in 10 innings moves the Sox into the American League Championship Series. In the other American League Divisional Series, the Yankees, behind Kevin Brown, beat the Twins 8-4. New York now leads 2-1. The two teams will meet in Game 4 in Minnesota this afternoon. In National League postseason action, Los Angeles travels to St. Louis for Game 3 in their series today. The Cardinals hold a 2-0 edge. Atlanta is in Houston, where Astros starter Brendan Bakke will try to lead his club to a 2-1 lead over the Braves. Joining me now on the line to talk about the World Series chances of the Bayou City Boys is Houston Chronicle columnist Richard Justice. Richard, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me, Bill.
We would not be talking now, you and I, if not for Houston's remarkable regular season turnaround. Could anyone have imagined back in June that the Astros, the team which could do nothing right, would end up the hottest team going into the playoffs?
No. You know, on August 15th, they had five teams to pass in the wild card race in the National League. They were seven games out. They had the fewest come-from-behind wins in the big leagues. They were talking about things like tearing the team apart. And what's funny, they went on 36-10 run. They had lots of things happen. They had an incident in the clubhouse that maybe did some team building. They had a beanball thing with the Chicago Cubs that helped. They made a couple of roster moves. But even if you ask them now, normally players will come back and say, see, you gave up on us. They will look you in the eye now and say, we had no idea. We were absolutely dead. We still don't understand how this happened.
To what extent did the replacement of Jimmy Williams with Phil Garner as manager contribute to that?
Well, you know, if you take a blueprint on how to build a baseball team and then how to correct the flaws, they tried everything. They first made a trade for a great player, Carlos Beltran from Kansas City. They thought they weren't scoring runs at the time. They thought, if we add this great player to the lineup, you know, Peter Gammons often talks about how one player keys the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Barry Bonds certainly does it in San Francisco. It will elevate everyone. They do that. It makes no difference at all. Then the next thing you do is you fire the manager. They fired the manager at the All-Star break, and for a month it did nothing. They brought in a guy who was living here in Houston, Phil Garner. He managed 10 years of Brewers and Tigers, and he's thinking after a month, that's it. I'm done. I'll never get another job ever in baseball. I'm radioactive, because he had finished. Ownership pulled the financial rug out from under him in both Milwaukee and Detroit. He had had nine straight losing seasons. He said, that's it for me. No one saw this coming, but I think when you look back, they kept working at it, and you cannot give them enough credit for the veteran players in that clubhouse, the guys like Brad Osmus and Jeff Bagwell, for if they continued to go out and play every day. When people like me were saying, forget it, it's over, let's go play golf. And they kept playing, and when you look back now, all those things apparently probably contributed in some way, but it's hard to tell which was most important and which fit where in the big puzzle.
Your list of veteran players who helped in the clubhouse was very short, and Roger Clemens wasn't on it. Should he have made the list?
Yes, he would have made the list. He was huge. You know, this season, everything this season was about was Roger Clemens. When he signed a week before the Super Bowl here, Andy Pettit had signed earlier, the phone lines melted down, basically, in the Astros ticket office. They had to bring temporary help and temporary computers in, and they drew a club record 3 million people, and that all starts with Roger Clemens coming here. And sports marketing people will tell you, he just the fact that he put on their uniform probably raised the value of the franchise 10%.
The Astros are the only team in the 2004 Divisional Series never to win a World Series. Though Houston has made the playoffs seven times, the team has never won a playoff series. Do fans in Houston feel that they own the distinction of being baseball's true long-suffering fans rather than, say, fans of the Red Sox or the Cubs?
Yeah, I think they feel like, you know, the Red Sox went to the World Series in 67, win in 86. At least you've been there. They've never gotten out of the first round, and they feel at different points they want to take different hostages and have them shipped out of town. The owner, Drayton McLean, gets criticized for not spending enough money. The first baseman, Jeff Bagwell, who's the highest-paid player, gets criticized. And even now when they go to Atlanta and win game one of the playoffs, people are going, well, what you hear mostly is, well, it's just a matter of time before the other shoe drops. So there's a lot of cynicism still.
The Astros have lost divisional series to their current opponents, the Atlanta Braves, in 97, 99, and 2001. Will Houston succumb a fourth time, or will the team make it to the league championship series for the first time since 1986?
When the series started, I was absolutely certain they were going to win. They finished with a 36-10 record. They were 19-2 in two-run and one-run games. But I just don't. The truth is, I don't know.
I mentioned 1986. Should the Red Sox and Astros make it to the World Series, there is a chance that former Boston ace Roger Clemens, also former New York ace Roger Clemens, but Boston for the sake of this discussion, could pitch in Game 7 in Fenway Park on Halloween. Now, from the perspective of someone who has followed the Astros all year, could there be a better ending to the 2004 season than that?
No, I mean, I guess that would be appropriate. I would think, you know, I think there are more demons confronting Roger if he has to go back to Yankee Stadium after saying, hey, I'm quitting. Oh, by the way, I'm not quitting. I believe he settled all his accounts with the fans at Fenway, and he got a warm ovation. Maybe that part of it is past, but that would be a great way to end it.
Richard Justice is a sports columnist for the Houston Chronicle. He joined me on the line from Houston. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you for having me.
In Game 1 of the best 2 out of 3 WNBA Championship Series, the Connecticut Sun slipped by the favored Seattle Storm 68-64 last night. The Sun took advantage of a large and noisy hometown crowd in the only game in the series that will be played in Connecticut. Rookie Lindsey Whalen sparked the Sun's defense to 15 steals. Katie Douglas, playing on a sprained ankle, led the Sun with 18 points. The Storm will host the Sun for Game 2 of the series in Seattle tomorrow.
I couldn't believe I'd made the first cut. Maybe I wasn't that bad after all. When I went into the locker room to change, the sophomores treated me with new respect. They even made room at the end of the benches for me.
That's Katie Douglas, a 6-foot guard slash forward out of Purdue, now playing for the Connecticut Sun. On Thursday, the day before her team met the Seattle Storm in Game 1 of the WNBA Finals, Douglas, a 4-year WNBA veteran, and her teammates spent an hour reading with hundreds of students at an elementary school in Salem, Connecticut. That may seem an odd way to prepare for a championship series, but the WNBA's 8th season has been unusual for several reasons, not the least of which has been a month-long suspension of league play to accommodate WNBA players from the U.S. and elsewhere who were competing in Athens, a circumstance which has pitted the women's league against competition it doesn't normally have to worry about. Katie Douglas acknowledges that playing this deep into the fall has been a little strange.
Definitely, it's different for me because I'm used to being done at this point in the season. So we know that we're competing with a tough audience. We got, like you said, you got college football, pro football, the World Series coming up soon. So we know we're competing, but when you put a good product on the floor, fans want to be a part of it and be a part of something special. And I think that's what our season has been.
Fans have wanted to be part of the Suns season to the tune of a 10% increase in attendance at home games this year. Winning has certainly helped. The team had never made the finals before, either as the Sun or in the club's earlier incarnation as the Orlando Miracle. But according to Bill Tavares, public relations director for the Sun, winning hasn't been everything or the only thing explaining the more encouraging numbers.
I think that if you had, you know, your preference, you would prefer to go all the way through the regular season and then get into the playoffs in September and sort of build from there. But, you know, if you have to have a break, I don't think it was the worst thing in the world to have a break where the United States Olympic team won a gold medal and one of the bigger stars in the game was playing in the championship game, Lauren Jackson from Seattle, for the Australians. And I think it worked out pretty well.
Sharon Robustelli, the senior director of WNBA Communications, has the league-wide evidence to back up Bill Tavares's contention.
It was better than last year. We're up about 10% for playoff attendance this year versus last year. So we're in good shape.
The increased interest in the playoffs notwithstanding, not all the numerical news out of the WNBA has been good. Though the 2003 champion Detroit Shock enjoyed a 20% increase in attendance, the San Antonio Silver Stars had to live with an 18% decline. Los Angeles was up 12, but Phoenix was down 10. Beyond that, the league's TV ratings were recently characterized by the Sports Business Journal as, quote, flat. According to Abe Madcore, the executive editor of that publication, part of the problem with the current numbers is that the WNBA started so strong.
In their first few years, they were averaging over 10,000 per game. Now that average is around 8,500 per game, so it's a little bit down. But you also need to remember they are really one of the, they are the longest running, surviving women's sports league in the United States. And so what they've been able to do has been quite impressive.
History and ambivalent attendance and television numbers were the last things on the minds of the kids in Salem, Connecticut on Thursday. They just wanted autographs.
Christine! Christine! Take one, Kevin! Take one, take one, take one! Take one! Thanks, thanks, thanks!
Wow, this is nice.
This particular posse surrounded Sun rookie Jessica Brungo.
You're welcome, you're welcome.
Brungo, a guard who graduated from Penn State last spring, signed the last child's piece of paper, then took an extra moment to agree that the Suns' playoff crowds had, in fact, grown, and to speculate on the reason for that happy development in a season that had been pushed into the most crowded time on the sports calendar.
Yeah, I know that was a concern of the league, but I think that, you know, the WNBA has a different fan base, and I think that it's been great that we've been able to keep up, you know, even with all the other sports that are going on right now.
Jessica Brungo's right about the WNBA's different fan base. According to the league office, 80% of those who attend games are female. But the WNBA's TV audience is more evenly split between men and women, which presents marketers with the challenge of selling the product to both genders. This year's autumn edition of the WNBA's summer game will come to its belated end either tomorrow or Tuesday in Seattle, depending on whether the sun or the storm prevails in Game 2 of the championship series tomorrow. It's 18 minutes past the hour. The children named after the TV sports network ESPN number at least three. ESPN McCall, a two-year-old, lives with his parents in Pampa, Texas. Two other lads named for the network were born in 2000. ESPN Curiel and Espen Blondiel, whose folks had the good sense, relatively speaking, to spell his first name ESPEN, so that teachers, camp counselors, and drill sergeants, among others with rosters before them, would know how to pronounce the youngster's name. The fact that at least three couples have named their children after the All Sports Network should perhaps not be construed as proof that people care more about sports than news until it can be demonstrated that nobody has named a child CBS, ABC, NBC, or CNN. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the minor leagues make the big time, and not everybody is thrilled about it. But first, the NBA's newest team is the Charlotte Bobcats. Their inaugural season kicks off on Thursday when the Bobcats host a preseason game against the Washington Wizards in their new home, the Charlotte Coliseum. The Coliseum, or the Hive, as it was affectionately known, is the old home of the team currently struggling to put fans in the seats in New Orleans. That's the Hornets, which is also what they were called when they played in Charlotte. Here to help us understand the on-again, off-again, and perhaps on-again love affair between Queen City Hoops fans and pro basketball is the Charlotte Observer's Rick Bunnell. Rick, thanks for joining me.
Oh, very happy to.
Even well before the Bobcats convened for training camp, Charlotte fans did seem confident that the new franchise would offer a vast improvement over the Hornets, if not on the court, then at least in some other ways. Is that an accurate observation?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, the very least you can say is that the new NBA owner in town has not been forced to go on court TV anytime lately. So that's some upgrade from the Hornets.
That's a start.
Yeah.
To what extent is this good feeling the result of the confidence locals have in broadcasting magnate and Bobcats owner Robert Johnson, as opposed to the loathing many still have for New Orleans Hornets owners Ray Wooldridge and George Shinn?
I think that city government has complete confidence in Bob Johnson. By and large, the town has more of a sense of sort of ambivalence, if not wariness, about second marriage, so to speak. I think it's fair to use that particular analogy. I think the town feels like they've been divorced and they didn't really like their ex-mate and they're wondering how this new one's going to work out.
Some of the game descriptions that I've read of the Hornets' last games in Charlotte were hilarious. At one point, I think they were saying that fans on opposite sides of the court could carry on a conversation without raising their voices. That's how few people were in the building. Will it be kind of not nearly so much fun to go and actually have a lot of company at games?
On the other hand, I think it will be a lot more fun not to feel like you're watching a sporting event in a mausoleum. It was so utterly bizarre, and I really, really felt sorry for the players because none of this, the political overtones, George Shinn's missteps, none of that was Baron Davis's fault or David Wesley's fault or anybody else's. The players felt like they were being victimized about something that, you know, they didn't contribute to.
Last week, Bobcats' number one draft pick, Amika Okafor, addressed a group of school kids, and he asked them if they were looking forward to seeing him dunk on Shaq. This is perhaps part of a bold new marketing plan cooked up by the Bobcats, yes?
I feel bad for Amika, and you can't say those things in front of a reporter and three television cameras without somebody saying, aha. Amika has spent the last 2 weeks sort of trying to disentangle himself so that people understand that that was not trash talking. It was trying to get a bunch of kids excited when most of them were half asleep.
The Miami Heat is not only Shaq's employer, but also a co-tenant in the NBA's Southeast Division. Will the NBA's recent realignment help to create instant rivalries for the Bobcats?
Well, I don't think they're going to be anybody's rival, to be totally honest, because I don't think they can be competitive night in and night out with anybody in the NBA. What it does do for them, there was a time long ago when any NBA team coming to town sold out a 23,000 plus seat arena. That is now ancient history. And what I'm getting at is, I'm sure Ed Tapscott, the president of the Bobcats, is very happy to have Shaq showing up not once a year but twice a year, and would probably be happy to have the Heat come in here and beat their doors in about 10 times so they could guarantee those sellouts.
The Hornets lived in Charlotte from 1988 until 2002. That team played well almost from the beginning and became a legitimate playoff contender sooner probably than most NBA franchise teams do. What do the Bobcats need to do to have a long, happy stay in Charlotte?
Not repeat the Hornets in what my mind was the beginning of the end mistake, which is that when push came to shove, George Shinn refused to pay Alonzo Mourning what another team, ironically enough, the Miami Heat, was willing to pay him, and therefore they didn't retain the exact player that defines a franchise. It will be very interesting, since Bob Johnson is not known as somebody who's real quick to spend his money. It'll be very interesting when he reaches the same crossroads, whoever it is who's on this roster, when you do not retain somebody who you can define as a franchise player, you're telling your fans to give up hope. And without hope, there is not life.
Rick Bunnell covered the Hornets and will cover the Bobcats for the Charlotte Observer. He joined me on the line from Charlotte. Thank you, Rick.
You're very welcome. Have a nice day.
Someday I will return with the merry laughs in my hand. Someday I will return with the merry laughs in my hand. I'm gonna take it for a honeymoon in some long, long distant land.
It has been said that if you can make your play your work, you will be a happy worker. Just ask Steve Holmes. He's the guy who turned his affection for minor league baseball into the production of a documentary film entitled The New Ball Game, a project that required him to travel all over the country watching baseball games. His chronicle of those travels may encourage baseball fans who are wondering where their sustenance will come from once this autumn's fall classic has given way to winter. Steve Holmes joins me now from the studios of WSUI in Iowa City. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, greetings from the heart of Cedar Rapids Colonel's country. Let's play three.
Why not? You acknowledge up front that this project would require real commitment and hard work, but no regrets about investing all that time in minor league ballparks, right?
No regrets at all. The only thing I would have to say about the pig that takes baseballs to a home plate in St. Paul, never stand at the north end of a southbound pig. Please don't ask me why. Just take my word for it.
Moving right along, aside from your obvious affection for minor league baseball, what else inspired the project?
The idea came about 10 years ago when I was coming back home from a Clinton Giants game. Clinton's a town of about 28,000 on the Mississippi River in Iowa. To give you some perspective, Clinton's entire population could fit into Yankee Stadium twice.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a pro team. And an Art Deco 1930s Depression-era ballpark. And it occurred to me, even then I knew the changes that were occurring in minor leagues that were making it tougher for small-town teams to get by. And I wondered how much longer that I could enjoy this wonderful little treat. And that led to the film idea, and eventually I conned persuaded Iowa Public Television to come in as co-producer.
There's a wonderful moment early in your film where Russ Kohler, a minor league player for some time, talks about the challenges and charms of the life. He's married, and he and his wife are living in the spare room of a family in the town where he plays. Let's listen to that for a minute.
We're broke. All the time we're broke. None of us have money. We're all living paycheck to paycheck. And if it weren't for people like Stan who could put us up in houses, we wouldn't be able to play anymore.
We can eat for three or four meals off of what we bought today for $5. And you have to learn how to do that, or else you're not going to make it. We know that the odds are against us, but to be able to be that old man that sits around and bore the crud out of all your friends about all those stories about all those podunk towns and crummy hotels and roach motels and bad food and crummy bus trips, I wouldn't take it back for the world.
Does this particular player, Russ Kohler, have any kind of shot at a major league career?
No, he was injured, and actually he spent much or most of his career of several years on the disabled list. He's out of the game now, but he's adjusting very well to that.
Did you find that this kid was representative? I mean, not only was he sort of resigned to living hand to mouth, but also that he wouldn't have changed anything, that he was pleased to have spent all those years in minor league baseball.
I think so. The hand-to-mouth part is pretty common, and that's frankly one of the charms of minor league baseball, is that when you go out to the ballpark in Cedar Rapids or wherever, chances are you're probably making more money than the guys down on the field. Isn't that a reversal? They make, at this level, which is below the halfway point in the minor leagues, maybe $850 a month, and they have to go out then and find other jobs in the off season. So the guy who you saw last week make this wonderful play at third base in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, might be a bartender or a part-time teacher this week.
Now, people who are unfamiliar with how important a minor league baseball team can be to a community's identity may learn something from Jackie Jeffries. She's an anthropologist at Texas A&M International University, and in your film, she's talking about the team in Laredo, Texas, the Tecolades, a Mexican League team that plays some of its games on the U.S. side of the river. Let's listen to her for a minute.
Baseball just transcends economic levels, social status, you know, religious differences, even language differences. You know, it transcends all those things. The more artistic endeavors tend to be limited to certain people of a certain status, and baseball's for everybody. I love that Laredo's known for something besides drug smuggling.
Now, that last business is particularly charming, I think. It wouldn't have occurred to me that that was the function of baseball, to give a town an identity other than being a drug smuggling capital.
We got in a bit of trouble for that in Laredo, actually. Said, no, don't even mention that. But I have some sad news to report. I mean, that's what happens when you do a program, is eventually parts of it need updating, mm-hmm. and that team is no longer there. It's another case of what you find in the major leagues. An owner says, we can't make it here. There's talk about a new ballpark, and sometimes in some of these cases, the city pulls its pockets inside out and said, we can't afford one. the team threatens to move, and in this case, it did move. I mean, it's what you find in the major leagues on a smaller version.
Now, that park in Laredo was, I believe, where you met Henry the Puffy Taco, and that must have been excruciating, or was Henry the most hideous of the mascots you encountered on your journey?
Henry has a charm to him. I mean, it's a six-foot-tall taco, for goodness sakes. How many times do you see that on the streets of wherever you live? I don't see it any more than two or three times a week, a giant taco.
Uh-huh.
So I had kind of an affection for Henry. What I don't understand are the mascots like the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. You don't want to be around a rattlesnake, really. It doesn't want to be around you. And yet they have a giant, fuzzy, warm and fuzzy rattlesnake wandering through the stands. And I'm thinking, this gives our children the wrong lesson, that it's okay to cozy up to a rattlesnake and ask it for an autograph.
Toward the end of the film, you seem resigned to the changes that have come to minor league baseball and will continue to come to it. But what will you miss most if the trend away from teams in very small markets continues?
I think I'm going to miss Dancing Bobby. Dancing Bobby, you see him right at the end of the film after, as the credits go by. He's a guy down in Burlington, Iowa, and he may have some kind of mental challenges. This is a big part of his life. Between innings, when they play the music on the PA system, he dances, and people come up to him and say hello to him. Hi, Bobby, how you doing? And it's not any kind of corporate, prepackaged, focus group-tested entertainment. It's just a guy who likes to dance. I think that kind of impromptu fun is what I would miss. So much of it nowadays in the minor leagues is corporate, tested, sanitized, prepackaged for your safety kind of entertainment. But so much of it, oh, well, I've seen this someplace else, and I've seen it done better someplace else. I'll miss Dancing Bobby if anything happens there.
Steve Holmes produced and narrated the new ball game, which has been seen on various public television stations and which was being shown at the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, during September and early October. You can see it there again next season. He spoke to me from the studios of WSUI in Iowa City. Thank you for joining me, Steve.
Thank you. I'm going to go play two now.
You're listening to Only a Game. From time to time, I mention to Charlie Pierce the odd, sometimes only vaguely related to sports, attempt to break a world record. Last week in that context, we discussed a pillow fight that had occurred in Africa, and that provoked R. Dean Ogilby, who hears Only a Game on New Hampshire Public Radio, to boast via email that for 11 consecutive years, Keene, New Hampshire has set a new world record for number of lit pumpkins, which apparently stands at 28,952. Mr. Ogilby writes that the next pumpkin festival will be held on October 23rd and adds, "The challenge is on." Herb Schulte of Kingston, New York, enjoyed my conversation last week with Arnold Hano about the catch Willie Mays made in the World Series 50 years ago, but he thought I should have included in that story the comment made by Don Little, who, facing just one batter that day, offered up the pitch that Vic Wertz hit about 500 feet. As he returned to the dugout, Little is said to have tossed his glove on the bench, smiled, and then said, "Well, I got my guy." A correction came from Jonathan Lippman, who hears Only a Game on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, and he didn't like the way I pronounced the name of the city that will next host the Summer Olympics.
The capital city of China is not pronounced Beijing, as if the J were French, but Beijing. It's a real J. Chinese is hard to pronounce, but this time what you see is what you get.
And finally, our celebration on last week's program of Ichiro Suzuki's achievement in breaking George Sisler's record for greatest number of base hits in a major league season did not convince Dave Albertson, a WBUR listener. 222 singles is way too many, he wrote. How could Ichiro, with his blazing speed, have only 24 doubles? I get the feeling that the reason for the 222 singles is that he chopped down on the ball and didn't take a full swing too much of the time. Isn't that a little like complaining about a basketball player who gets a lot of his or her points on layups? You can comment on these and other matters by emailing us at onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a correction or any sort of comment you like on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
Lines are to left, lines are to right. It's in the day, it's it at night. Ichiro carries a dangerous bat, and there's nothing a pitcher can do about that. It's up the middle, then hits it deep. It's in the clutch, it's in his sleep. Whether in English or in Japanese, we can all understand what an RBI means. And because of what he can do...
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll see whether yoga can improve your golf and perhaps whether golf can improve your yoga. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me on the telephone for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Atlanta Braves and the Houston Astros head into today's Game 3 all even, thanks in part to clutch hitting made possible by a judge's ruling, which allowed Braves shortstop Rafael Furcal to play out the season rather than go to jail. Apparently, justice is still with the Braves.
Well, no, he's actually working for ESPN.
That was a little joke there, David Justice.
I am in South Carolina at Georgia this week, and watching the change of heart of the fans in one day was remarkable. For a day, we had special treatment for athletes, lock them all up, hang them by their thumbs, put them in the socks, and today it's like our Rafi coming back from adversity.
Yeah.
This is parallel, by the way, to a situation 13, 14 years ago with Scott Skiles, who was playing in the NCAA tournament for Michigan State, and he would go to jail as soon as the NCAA tournament ended, which always led me to believe that he played the NCAA tournament with far more motivation than anyone ever has. I think Furcal may be in the same situation.
Absolutely. The Cardinals own a two-game lead over the Dodgers in their best-of-five divisional series, but the best story from St. Louis this week, I think, was the one involving Los Angeles slugger Milton Bradley and an intrepid TV crew.
Yeah, this was very bizarre. First of all, I think the best story out of St. Louis is that Tony La Russa hasn't screwed up a playoff series yet, but that's neither here nor there.
It's still early.
Apparently he got into a wrangle with Jason Reed, the Dodgers beat writer for the Los Angeles Times, and called him an Uncle Tom, which sent Reed off. A Fox TV crew was there filming the whole thing. The Dodgers PR people demanded the tape, and the Fox crew surrendered it, which is just a very, very strange. I mean, first of all, where does the Dodgers PR crew get off? And then second of all, where does the film crew get off?
It does rather suggest that sports and real news coverage do diverge, doesn't
well,
it?
No. I mean, it happens. You know, you're talking about media people being rousted by the Secret Service and visits by President Bush's service in various places. I think the two lines are getting closer than you know.
Right. Dale Earnhardt Jr. lost an advantage that he'd won on the track as well as $10,000 for allowing a vulgar word to creep into his post-race interview after the action in Talladega on Sunday. Are we witnessing the sanitizing of NASCAR?
Well, the point penalty is far more serious than the actual fine, which will get paid by one of the several decals that are on Dale Earnhardt's car. This is the kind of thing in a very close Nextel Cup race this year that could really cost him some money down the line. And I think, you know, we've talked about the mainstreaming of NASCAR. Being Mr. NASCAR, I, of course, followed this development as best I can.
I count on it.
Now, of all things, NASCAR is going to get boring. NASCAR is going to turn into golf. Can we abide this?
Tiger Woods has not been his customary winning self on the PGA Tour lately, speaking of golf, perhaps because his mind has been on the wedding in which he participated on Tuesday in Barbados. Any sense of whether marriage will help his golf game?
Oh, if you think I'm going down this road and get all those letters and emails again, you're out of your mind. No, I think the more point is, you know, he's found his life partner. Now it's time to rehire his swing coach.
NBA training camps are underway, Charlie, featuring more controversy perhaps than usual. Transcontinental barbs traded between Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant. Jason Kidd doing everything he can to get himself traded out of New Jersey. What's going on here?
Well, I think, you know, you've got a couple of extraordinary events. The kind of
unsatisfactory to all concerns ending of the Kobe Bryant saga out in Colorado, and then the subsequent really kind of underhanded leaking of virtually all the investigative materials by the local law enforcement, the rift between Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal, which was always there to turn into the Grand Canyon. As for Jason Kidd, his team has fallen apart around him. And it's not like Jason doesn't have a record of becoming dissatisfied very quickly.
Scottie Pippen, who played for 17 years in the NBA, announced his retirement this week. Do you suppose it was because he didn't want to risk another season in which he would miss the playoffs?
No, I think it's been time for Scottie for a while. He's managed to prolong it a little bit. He got to come home to Chicago and take the victory lap around. The Chicago Bulls are hopeless. There's not going to be any great desire on a part of a playoff team to have Scottie Pippen aboard. It's time.
At a press conference this week, Amika Okafor, who plays for the Charlotte Bobcats, tried to encourage a group of children to attend a preseason game by asking, quote, "Don't you guys want to see me dunk on Shaq?" I wonder if by the time Mr. Okafor has been in the league for, oh, say, 17 years, perhaps he'll have learned not to say things like that.
This was the guy who graduated from Connecticut with a 3.8 in international finance and was the shining example of people getting smart and becoming good basketball players at the same time. Emeka, a tip. You start with Greg Ostertag and you work your way up.
Yeah, I was going to say, finance, not diplomacy. In WNBA postseason action, despite a broken nose, Sue Bird led the Seattle Storm into the finals. In the deciding game of those conference finals, the Storm knocked down 12 of 16 from three-point range. Any truth to the rumor they'll be putting on a clinic for the U.S. men's team?
Well, they certainly can't hit the mid-range jump shot, can't they? And, of course, you've got the intriguing matchup now of Sue Bird coming home to Connecticut to play for the championship.
Yep. On Tuesday, Ricky Williams, late of the Miami Dolphins, asked his agent to explore the possibility that he might rejoin the team. I wonder, would the $8.6 million he might otherwise have to pay the Dolphins for breach of contract have anything to do with that decision?
Bill, remember, that's why they call it dope. I think the 8 million reasons he has for coming back, I think the love of the game is probably the 8.6 millionth and one reason he has for coming back to the game.
Charlie, we should wish Rodney Dangerfield true greens on that great Lynx in the sky. The man who created one of film's most memorably uncouth golfers died this week. Dangerfield, of course, starred in the 1980 film Caddyshack.
And if I may say so, let's go while we're young!
The man who completed a record 58 Boston Marathons also died this week, Charlie, on Wednesday. How would you like people to remember Johnny Kelly?
Well, they can come to my neighborhood in Massachusetts and look at his statue, which is at the base of the beginning of the Hills of Newton, which have destroyed many an opportunity for people to win that race. I mean, he really was one of the last connections to that race when it really was run for a laurel wreath and a bowl of beef stew.
And finally, a soccer team in Italy, Isola Capo Rizzuto, distinguished itself.
I had that last night.
And was it good?
With the Chianti, it was wonderful.
Excellent. Anyway, this team distinguished itself during a game this week by requesting a moment of silence to honor a fellow who might charitably be characterized as dubious, don't you think?
Well, he was a local mafia boss, and they elected to have the moment of silence, and the referee agreed to have it. What is the referee going to do, say no?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
For more on this week's stories, pictures from stories past and present, commentaries galore, and the opportunity to write email to us, check out our website, onlyagame.org. Since the first time man put stick to ball in the game which has come to be known as golf, golfers have been searching for ways to lower their scores. As Only a Game's Karen Given reports, sometimes that quest leads to unexpected places.
Introducing the Check Go by Technisonic. Check Go's high-speed gyroscopic action realigns the ball's variance to show you its optimal balance point.
Introducing the inside approach, the easiest, fastest way to straighten out your slice, increase your distance, and lower your scores in six swings or less.
With a dual hinge that can find any flaw in your golf swing, once you stop breaking it, you'll groove the perfect swing.
Any golfer who's ever watched late-night television is familiar with the seemingly never-ending march of innovation and technology designed to improve one's golf game. But the latest craze in golf is based on something much, much older.
Close your eyes. Imagine that you are stepping out onto a beautiful golf course.
In the pro shop at the Green Hill Municipal Golf Course in Worcester, Massachusetts, yoga instructor Aletha McGuigan has pushed the snack tables aside and lit a row of candles to create just the right mood for her Golf Fit yoga class. Classes like this one are springing up from Phoenix, Arizona to Galena, Maryland, and Calgary, Canada to Cornwall, England.
I would imagine that any golfer that does any style of yoga, it would be beneficial.
Catherine Roberts has been teaching her trademarked Yoga for Golfers program for nearly 7 years and has produced a book and 5 DVDs, with a 6th due out next week. She says dozens of pros use yoga to improve their game.
Brad Faxon, Stuart Sink, J.L. Lewis, Aaron Baddeley, Jonathan Kay, Gary McCord, all of these guys are doing yoga. From a female perspective, LPGA perspective, Jill McGill, Julie Inkster, Betsy King. So, you know, the list just goes on and on and on.
Roberts is a golf biomechanical specialist who's been working with professional athletes for 20 years. She's also been playing golf since she was a teenager and credits yoga with reducing her handicap from a 24 to a 16. That's because Roberts says yoga builds strength, flexibility, and balance, all important physical attributes for a good golf game. But for golfers, especially for stressed-out, type-A personalities, Roberts says the practice helps them slow down, breathe, and develop the mental focus that's key to the game.
If you've had a double bogey and you're walking up to the next tee, you have to absolutely let that double bogey go and be completely focused on the task at hand, which is the shot that you're standing over right at that moment. And yoga teaches you to let go of past things and not think about the future, just be very present and fully focused.
The most precious piece of equipment a golfer has is the body. And the golfer's mind and spirit should be equally as fit.
As the sun sets over the golf course in Worcester, Aletha McGuigan prepares her students for their weekly practice. McGuigan's a nurse and yoga instructor who's been training since she was 5, with her mother, also an instructor, and Swami Vishnudevananda. She wasn't thinking about national trends or DVD sets when she started researching her own Golf Fit yoga program. She was just setting out to learn the game of golf and doing what she's always done.
She was stretching before a lesson. I said, what the heck are you doing? Laying on the ground? Get up.
Green Hills golf pro Jim Finner got over his shock while attempting to give McGuigan her first lesson and eventually joined in for some stretches of his own. Finner had tried yoga once before and was surprised by the results.
When we did one of the positions, balance positions, I fell over. And I thought I had good balance being a golf pro. I realized I really didn't. So the big part of this program is for me the balance and also the meditation part of it.
Finner and McGuigan agree that yoga can be a little intimidating for the average golfer. So McGuigan thought long and hard about the postures that could improve a golfer's game and how to appeal to someone already worn out after a round of 18.
I was thinking about what props I could use, you know, and make it really golfy. So I thought we would massage our feet with the golf ball. So it's like a therapeutic maneuver. I mean, it feels great when you take off your golf shoes at the end of the game, but of course we have to hit the balls into the water afterwards or sterilize them.
Like many yogis, McGuigan seems capable of folding herself like a pretzel. But in this class, she illustrates more accessible postures. She's even renamed some of the traditional yoga moves to fit the theme. Take, for example, the pose she describes as the birdie.
It's also called the crane. This posture aligns and sets your body for a balanced golf posture. Grab hold of your ankle or your foot, and with your other arm, you can use it for balance. And we're going to hold this for 5 seconds. One.
Bernadette and Carl Genetasio are a pretty good example of the range of abilities in this class. Bernadette's a veteran of Pilates and well-versed on some yoga principles. As Carl struggles to balance on one foot, it's obvious that he is not.
It helps to pick a focal point on the wall.
Carl has considerably less trouble when it comes time to balance on the other foot. He's quick to agree that if this class wasn't at a golf course, he probably wouldn't be here.
I probably wouldn't, but golf was the catalyst to get me here, and I enjoy it. It's soothing and peaceful, and it's good for you.
Has it helped your golf game?
I don't think so, because, you know, you have to do it more than once. You know, if I did it probably before I played each round, more than likely it would, because there are some feelings that you get that you think would help you.
Bernadette interjects that this is only Carl's fourth class, and maybe he just hasn't seen the benefits yet. For her, yoga is a welcome addition to their time at the golf course.
It's very stressful. I said, we come out here to enjoy ourselves, and all we do is curse because we made a stupid shot or it didn't go where you wanted it to go. And I said, this is supposed to reduce stress, but I'm getting stressed from playing the game.
Visualize a clear blue sky and the feeling of peace and freedom enveloping you.
As McGuigan leads the class through a relaxing visualization, stress seems to be the last thing on anybody's mind. Serious golfers like Jim Finner have been using visualization to work through the perfect swing or putt for years, but Finner says now it's different.
I would visualize the shot I'd wanted to make, but now I just do a little more peacefully. I involve the trees and the grass a little bit more into it. Just makes golf a little more enjoyable. You got to remember to smell the roses while you're out there.
For her part, Catherine Roberts says she's happy to have introduced some of this country's 26 million golfers, many of whom would never have dreamed of entering a yoga studio, to the benefits of the practice. And she says it wouldn't be a stretch to bring some of the 15 million yoga practitioners in the U.S. to the game of golf.
Some of the most meditative, zen-like feelings I've had, some of the most connected feelings that I've had, have happened on the golf course. A golf course, when the sun is setting, is one of the most beautiful things you can see. It's, you know, a way to connect with nature, especially if you can walk. And I think yogis would love to play golf. If they can take their yogic philosophy and apply it to golf, they'll be that much better.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Thanks this week to John Bulwit at member station WSUI in Iowa City. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Golf Fit Yoga, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from golf pro and yoga neophyte Jim Fenner, who describes a conversation with yoga instructor Aletha McGuigan.
When we first started talking about it, she brought the candles, and I said, there's no candles in golf.
Jim lost that argument, though, didn't he? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. This is NPR, National Public Radio.